Welcome, everybody, to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course, I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. Super excited. This is going to be great.
Yeah, so am I. Joining us today, we have a very special guest, two-time Oscar-nominated film editor Craig McKay. He's here to have a chat with us about his amazing work, which spans multiple genres and forms over the past 30 years. Having had the chance to work with a slew of hugely talented filmmakers over the course of his terrific career, including Warren Beatty, John McNaughton, James Mangold, Cary Fukunaga, Robert Redford, and multiple films for Jonathan Demme. Craig's created a powerful body of work that time and time again has represented the very best that editing has to offer in any given year for movies. With too many credits to list in an intro, we're just going to dive right in. We're going to explore his fascinating filmography, find out a little bit about his background. So welcome to the show, Craig. It's a big honor to have you here today. Thank you very much for coming on.
Great to be here. Good to talk to you guys.
Yeah, this is fantastic. Looking over your filmography is insane. You've edited so many of my favorite films. I can't even wait to dig in. I don't even know where to start, honestly. I mean, thrown out a couple of them: Reds, Something Wild, Silence of the Lambs, Philadelphia, particularly Copland. Nick and I love Copland. We've been huge proponents of that film ever since we met online and have talked about film. So I guess let's start with Copland. How did you become involved with that project?
I was a creative advisor at Sundance Director's Lab with Redford and a number of other distinguished people who were talking to 10 students, 5 to 10 students every year, 10 screenplays, and then, you're paired off with each one of the directors. I happened to be paired off with James Mangold on that one, and he had brought Copland to Sundance. And then I also found out, I saw a short that he had directed, and I found out that he grew up in the town next to where I grew up in the Hudson Valley, so we had sort of a little Hudson Valley boys affinity going on there. And and so we went to the lab together, and then at some point he called me later, 2 months later, saying that he had financing with Harvey Weinstein, and he was interested in my participation in the picture. And so I asked him how much his budget was, and he told me at the point, I think it was $5 million. And I wasn't sure he could afford me. And so I said, have your producer call me at some point and we'll talk. And in the interim, they ended up hiring De Niro and Keitel and Stallone. And so the budget went from 5 to, I'm not sure what it went to, but it skyrocketed. And I talked to him. He called me back, actually, and said, I think we can afford you now. In the interim, while all that was happening, he had directed a small film called Hetty, and I had helped him out with some comments and stuff. And so the relationship was getting stronger and stronger. And then we were finally able to make a deal, and I was on Copland for quite a while. And it went through a lot of different versions. The last version, we changed the ending completely, but had a great time working with Jimmy, very knowledgeable person, and very emphatic about what he wanted, and so was I. So, I mean, it actually worked pretty well. We really never butted heads. We just kind of, we tried to make the film better with every, turn we took with it. It's interesting, at the time, when we were doing it, I'm a guitar player, so I went out and bought a Fender Telecaster guitar, and I didn't want my wife to know about it, so I hid it in the cutting room, and then I was playing it one day, and Jim came in, and we started doing stuff, and we found out that we liked Johnny Cash a lot, and the guitar that was used on all of Cash's recordings by Luther Perkins was a Fender Telecaster. So we would be picking, while we were doing Copland, we would be picking some Johnny Cash songs, and at that point he told me that he wanted to do a film about, you know, Johnny Cash. So that was, well, you know, early walk the line stuff going on there.
Wow. So you mentioned that the ending was completely redone. Because I notice from the ending of the film, one of the things is Robert De Niro has his mustache from Jackie Brown, as opposed to the mustache he had in the film, and I always thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, you know, it was a little crazy. I mean, the problem with the film had a much bigger problem, which is that, and we held several previews. The ending was not the problem, and many, you know, the mismatch, you know, is a mismatch. Those things do happen. Of course, we can fix it visually now. In those days, actually, in those days, we were starting to be able to do that. The big problem the film had was that nobody would accept Stallone in that character.
Right.
And I must say, you know, I've cut a lot of performances of major actors. His performance was absolutely brilliant in that film.
It's amazing.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, no, his performance is amazing, and it's one of the things that makes the movie so memorable, and it's one of the things that, for me, has stood out about the film forever. And you know, I just think that it's, again, I think expectations can sometimes be the mother of all disappointments, and I think that I think that there was probably some sort of expectation about what the movie should have been or what it was going to be. And you're right. I think that, you know, Stallone was caught in that interesting transitional period at the time where he was still trying to crank out action films and they weren't the biggest hits at the box office. And then he made his career come back, you know, a few years later. And Copland is just like this quiet, you know, it's like this quiet Western taking place in modern times. And, you know, he's like
exactly
the sheriff
right.
And I just like with that, and I love it. And was the Western motif something that you guys were conscious of discussing? And like, did you ever feel like you were cutting together Western?
No, I think we were cutting an Eastern.
An Eastern.
yeah, with Western. I was like, I was kind of Eastern. That was very much an Eastern. But no, actually, you know, homage to many Westerns. It was always there just below the surface. And, but the problem we were having, it was hard to fix and get it to the point where we got it to. Actually, some of our Stallone stuff had to be diminished because of you know, people not accepting his performance.
Yeah, I just to chime in with what you guys are saying about Stallone is I'm a huge Stallone fan. I've loved Stallone forever. I think he's a brilliant writer, director, as well as an actor. And I think that Copland is one of those incredibly special movies where he is able to shake everything off and he blends into the character and you don't see Sylvester Stallone. You see Freddy the Sheriff. And I think what's even more remarkable about that film is how he's supported by this just plethora of amazing actors.
I know.
And no one overshadows him. Right, no one overshadows him, and everybody kind of takes a back seat to Stallone in that film.
I know, sorry, I couldn't, you know, it was really frustrating putting it together and, you know, sitting with Jim and seeing how the audience reacted. We got it to the point where we thought people would accept it. And we couldn't actually take it any further. I went through many cuts, including the ending. I think there were several endings, which I can't even remember now. I did so many of them. But the last one was at Harvey Weinstein's suggestion. And that's what we decided to go with. It's interesting. And Stallone was truly magnificent. I mean, it was a class A performance. It was right up there with anything I've ever done. Any of the Oscar performances that I worked on, it was right there. And there's a story that was going around set that his wife was thanking everybody because of the way he was behaving, giving this performance, truly changed his personality on some level. And so she was very grateful. Early story was that I was looking at a movie called Thieves, and the director had a bad back, and Bob Fosse came in to help out. And so I was working with Bob for a month or so. And we got to be pretty friendly. I loved Fosse. He was an absolute genius filmmaker, as far as I'm concerned. He came in one day, and he threw a script on my editing bench. He said, take a look at that. Let me know what you think. And I, this is 1976, and I'm looking at the script, and the script was called Rocky. And I read the script, and I came in the next day, and he said, what do you think? I said, I think it's a really good script. He said, the only problem is that the guy who wrote it wants to star in it, and the studio doesn't want to let him do it. And he said, what do you think? I said, I think they should let him do it. The story was too good. But, so Fosse's recommendation to John, the director, was, yeah, you should go ahead and hire that kid because, it's obvious there was more talent there than, just on a piece of paper.
Wow.
And so Bob Fosse came in to work on, you said, this is Thieves.
Yeah.
Wow.
He had a scene, in it. And that's what we worked on together for a while.
Yeah, Frank and I, we did a podcast earlier this year on Star 80, and his work is stuff that we're really, really big fans of. So that's amazing that you had a chance to get in his orbit for a bit.
Oh yeah, as a matter of fact, he threw me another script, and he said, "Take a look at this one." And I looked at that, and it was All That Jazz. And he said to me, he said, "What do you think?" I said, "That's your story, isn't it?" He goes, yeah, it's my story. I said, you should do it. He said, yeah, I'm going to do it. He said, I think this is the last one I've got in it. He knew he had a bad heart attack. I mean, bad heart from a heart attack. And he said, this will be my last one. Well, it wasn't Star 80. It was his last one. But he'd be in the cutting room working with me, and he always had a Camel in the corner of his mouth all day. He was breathing. I couldn't believe it. I didn't know how he did it. But anyway, he thought All That Jazz was going to be his last film. He knew that there were, health issues.
Right. Yeah, All That Jazz is incredible. That's my all-time favorite movie.
Yeah.
Alan Hine is incredible.
Alan Hine did such a spectacular job of editing that. He was one of my mentors when I was first starting
on
features. Yeah. I had a number of them. I'm very lucky, some very talented people mentored me, and Barry Malkin, Evan Lottman, Alan Hine, and Dee Dee Allen. Dee Dee Allen's was less of a mentorship, except she knew me. We had worked together on a couple of films, and then she called me up one day. I was finishing up Melvin and Howard. And she called me and she said, I'm doing this film and I need a partner. It's about the Russian Revolution. And I said, oh, that sounds interesting. But I was more interested in working with Dee Dee, quite frankly, one of the greatest editors we ever had. And to be in that orbit, was something that I don't know how you can say no to it. But she did call me and I said yes, and we became partners for over 2 years on that film.
It's incredible. I mean, I was going to ask, you sort of answered the question before I could ask. It was sort of how you got your, who were your inspirations and if you had mentors and how did you get your, your start? Before we get into more titles, because it's like overwhelming, but where was the first thought to become an editor? Like, when did you have that?
Well, Richard, let me back up a little. I remember my grandmother taking me to see a movie when I was 5 years old. And it was 1949, and it was called The Secret Garden with Margaret O'Brien. And I can remember sitting in the theater looking at this big screen, and there was something about it. I just knew somehow I wanted to be around or involved with it. And so I knew at a very, and I'm not kidding, at a very early age, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to make movies. And as a kid growing up, I was a handicapped kid, so I really couldn't do sports. And so I, gravitated toward the arts. And I was interested in puppets and drawing and photography and lighting and music. And so I sort of embraced all of that, and all of it really for me added up to the film. And I, I remember going to the theater and watching the lighting and then coming back. And I was fortunate enough to have my family supported that idea for me. And so in my early teens, they bought me a 16 Bolex. And so I was making movies in the neighborhood, and I'd see lighting in the theater where I grew up, and which is the Hudson Valley. And I would try to, copy the lighting so I could see what they were doing. And then when I was about 17, 18, they were shooting a movie two towns over from where I was, and I had to be there. And so every day I would skip school and go over to Milton, New York, which they were shooting a movie called The Fugitive Kind, with Marlon Brando, Anna Magnani, and Joanne Woodward. Mm-hmm. And I would hang around the set, and I became friendly with Victor Jory, who was one of the character actors, great character actor in it. And he would tell me what things are, because there was no film school in those days. There were three pages in the World Book Encyclopedia that told you how to make movies. And so Victor would say, that's a Mitchell BNC, that's a 10K light, that's a cutter, that's a Kubelaris, So I got to know some of those terms. And that film was directed by Sidney Lumet. And 10 years later, I was working for Sidney in the business. So we're doing a film for Warner Brothers called Blood Kin, which lasted about 3 days in the theater. It was written by Tennessee Williams. And I was mostly interested in cinematography, to be honest with you. I didn't really have any interest in any, except when I was putting my own stuff together. So I started out wanting to be camera. And actually, I ended up working in a commercial house. I started at a can carrier, carrying film to laboratories, and I worked myself up to an apprenticeship. And then the company I was working for, Cinemetrics, started a production company, and I started shooting low-budget commercials, shots here and there. And then I realized at some point, as I was getting more successful, that Madison Avenue was only interested in pretty pictures, and I was very much interested in storytelling. And so that's when my friend Richie Marks, who's a well-known editor, Apocalypse Now, and et cetera, we were working together. We both started as messengers. And he said, well, why don't you come back to the cutting room? It's one place where you have to know a little bit about everything, and it all comes together. And they sent, so I jumped course and, headed back into the cutting room. And I knew a couple of people, which helped me get there. And gradually worked my way up, So I was really a foot soldier. And there weren't really any film schools around. There were very few film books around. I think there was one book by Carol Reese on editing that I remember reading years ago. It was basically, I had no family in the business, and I had met someone who had a company and had offered me a job, and I took it in New York, which was about 65 miles from where I grew up. And I loved every minute of it and passionate about it. And I still am to this day.
Jeez. That's fantastic. That's so cool. It's such a cool, a very cool story of how you got involved. It's so cool to talk to so many different people and hear about their entrance into the business and how a lot of people kind of cut their own way through it, and mm-hmm. They didn't know anybody. And that's very cool. I wanted to ask you about, I guess we're going to bounce around here a little bit, not go so much chronologically, but your work with Jonathan Demme,
mm-hmm.
and your collaborations with him. I love Jonathan Demme. I love him. Mm-hmm. And particularly the ones that you were involved with him on. I guess I want to maybe start with Something Wild. I think that that film is fantastic. And I think that that film, for me, what makes that film so great is the tone shift and how it becomes a completely different film once Ray Liotta enters the frame.
Yeah. Is that
and
not
how
one of
everything
the,
gets...
Is that not
ahead.
One of the great entrances in a movie?
Oh,
when,
yeah.
When Ray shows up, the whole thing just turns on a dime. That's amazing. He's amazing.
Exactly. It just, everything aesthetically, thematically, everything completely changes. And I'm wondering how you guys achieved that to the degree you did. I mean, everything, the pacing, everything. I mean, it's fantastic to me, and I'm obsessed with it every time I watch it.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, actually, the audience, a large number of people in the audience were really kind of pissed off about that turn the movie took. Some people accepted it. Some people, you know. Here's the thing. You know, when you sit down to watch a movie, there's a promise to the audience of what the movie is going to be about. And the promise of Something Wild was a, you know, situation comedy. And so I guess some of the audience felt very much betrayed when it didn't turn out that way. But it was always the intent. I mean, that was a seminal picture for Jonathan and I and Tak Fujimoto, our cinematographer. One of the things that we started to discover with some of the earlier films we did was that actually developed into our sort of rule of thumb, which never let the audience get ahead of the story. And that started to show itself in Something Wild, the way the narrative moved forward. And so we deliberately set about developing that. So we felt that, you know, you're going to get a tromp if, you know, if the audience can never get ahead of the story. And that was pretty much what happened. You know, the script was great. Gary Maxwell, he wrote a great script. Jonathan, and I think it was amazing how fast that we turned that film out. From the first day of shooting until the final answer print took 6 months. That's unheard of. Films back then were being done in 10, 11 months. It came together almost magically and very fast. And the great fun for me is, you know, being an ex-musician was I was like cutting to music and stuff. And of course, there was a plethora of music and great music in
yeah.
the film. And in fact, the album sold really well. The thing about it was that there was always an edge to the story, you know, with Audrey. So you never quite knew what was going to happen or where he was going to end up. And so the fact that it got so dark, I think, makes it extremely prerogative. I mean, extremely, I'm losing the word, provocative. And they were all brilliant performances. They were all great. And Melanie was just absolutely fantastic in it, and Jeff was great. And Ray was just, I mean, I remember when I first cut that scene together, you know, knocked me off my chair. You know, you could really feel the turn, even in the dailies, you know. And the way Jonathan shows it, he just comes in around the corner and goes, "Hi, Audrey," you know, and you know, you put your seatbelt on, put your neck brace on, you know, it's going to go somewhere. And it was a great, great experience. And it was really formative for us because a lot of the stuff we developed and sort of understood in terms of moving the narrative forward got directly applied in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
So, it was, the studio couldn't believe how fast we turned it out. I couldn't believe how fast we turned it. And this, you know, that thing was cut on a moviola. There were no Avids or, you know, anything like that. And so I'm very proud of that one. It's one of my all-time favorites, and it's a great movie, and it's very Demi. I mean, you know, I can remember the first time I was cutting some television movie. I can't remember. I've done a number of those. Barry Malcolm called me, who had cut one of Jonathan's features, The Last Embrace. And Barry had asked him to work on Melvin and Howard. And Barry couldn't do it because he had already committed himself to another film. So Barry Malcolm recommended me to Jonathan Demme. And so we agreed to meet for lunch, and I had read the script. He sent me the script. And we said, you know, we're there at lunch, and he said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I don't think much of the script. I really don't. It was a ballsy thing to say when you're trying to get a gig. But no, I didn't like it that much. He says, oh. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, it seems rather conventional and stuff. I said, I'll tell you what I do like, though. I like the way you perceive the distortion of the American dream. I had seen Handle with Care and loved it. And I said, that's what I like. I want to work on this film because of you, because of what you'll bring to it. I can tell that, you know, your sensibilities are something I'm aligned with. And so he gave me the gig based on that. I was still finishing this other TV movie, and he said, well, we start on this date. And I was still almost finishing the other movie. I said, well, I can't start until this date, which was 6 weeks into shooting. And he said, I don't know. And so apparently Jonathan called Barry Malcolm and said, he can't start for 6 weeks. Barry said to him, hire him. Was insistent on it. So now what happened parallel to that is that I had worked on a miniseries called Holocaust. And my show, Show 3, won all the awards. When they called me in to do the show, they said, we're sorry, this is the worst show we have, but, you know, we'd like you to bring what you can to it. And so something about the subject matter affected me deeply, and I put everything into it, and turns out I won an Emmy, and I won an Eddie Award for that, which is the ACE Eddie Award. And so when Jonathan had to call the studio on Melvin and Howard and say, he can't start for 6 weeks, the studio went, well, who the hell is Craig McKay? And Jonathan said, well, he just won an Emmy, and he just won the Eddie Award for the miniseries Holocaust. And that was the end of it. They waited for me for 6 weeks. So kind of wild way to get there, but we got there. I truly love that film. That film... Alan Hahn used to say to me that film is hung on pure gossamer, and that's about as close to the truth as you can get.
Well, I just want to back up real quick to something you said. You said you cut Something Wild on a Moviola.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I can't even believe that, because I went to film school and that's how we cut film, was on a Moviola, and I can't even believe that.
Why? I don't understand.
I just...
It's that piece of equipment can do everything, you know, except some of the visual effects. You can do everything with a movie,
right,
like you did with, you know, Avid or Final Cut Pro. The thing is that kind of editing in those days was nonlinear, because you had every shot separate and you controlled it separately. So when everybody was going digital saying, you know, I'm working nonlinear now, and I always say to them, well, I've been working nonlinear for years, you know, so it wasn't any different. I could do anything with a Moviola editorially that I could do on Avid, you know.
Yeah,
it just took longer.
So.
It took much longer.
Yeah,
and when you were preparing to cut a scene.
I can remember when I was doing my little film school stuff, and there was, you know, film all over the dorm room and everything else. And I can remember sitting at a Moviola, and yeah, I think that what is just so interesting is that the dramatic shift in technology the last, you know, 10, you know, 10 things have gone digitally, and, you know, I know there's always a few holdouts. Is there anybody still cutting on film anymore? I know, like, I remember reading a few years ago that Spielberg was still doing it here and there, but I mean, is there anybody that's still doing it?
Well, I think I think he might still be, although I've heard, I haven't spoken with Michael Connor in a while, so I don't know what he's up to, but he was, I was asked doing a film called K-Pax at Universal, and I needed, they were showing me cutting rooms I could use, and they showed me the Amblin cutting rooms, which were Michael Kahn's cutting rooms with Spielberg, and the rooms were too small. They were too small because he was still cutting on moviolas. They couldn't fit an Avid into the room. You could fit a moviola in, but you couldn't fit an Avid into the room. So I think he probably played that out as long as he could, although I don't know specifically, but I guess he's using Avid by now. I don't think I know anybody who is holding on to it, you know. I mean, I used to work in the Brill Building and at a place called 1619, a post-production facility. And I remember coming in one day after I'd been on Avid for about a year or so, and I remember looking down the hallway, and all I saw was this long line of old moviolas, as far as I could see. And, and they were getting rid of all of them. It was like, it was heartbreaking. But I embrace the new technology. Again, I'm sorry.
It's like the moviola graveyard.
It was, yeah. But I totally embrace the new technology. I love it. It certainly makes things easier on many, many levels. And I found that the editor has now become more of an orchestrator than he was because of all the decisions that can now be made directly in front of you. So I feel it has changed the position significantly.
Yeah, and I know we'll come back to the work because I know, just like Frank said, Demi's work as well. I think it's such an eclectic mix of so many different tones, and I'm a big, big fan of movies that, turn on a dime and become something that you weren't expecting, something mm-hmm. wild, certainly being one of the best examples of that. But I just wanted to mention, because when you look at your credits, the extended list that you can find online, you had a chance to work on some unbelievable stuff early on in your career. One of the movies, I'm just so curious about it because I had never heard about it and I just recently saw it. It's a movie called Who Is Harry Kellerman and Why Is He Saying Those Terrible Things About Me? I'm just wondering. it's listed as you were an associate film editor. And, right. You've got these really, like The Wanderers is on here and Night Moves and, and I'm just curious to know about Who Is Harry Kellerman, because it's such a bizarre movie and it's so unique and I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. And I can't even dream of somebody like attempting to make a movie. I mean, it was funny when I was watching it, I kind of said to myself, this is Birdman before Birdman was Birdman. I was kind of wondering if you had any recollections about that, and how you came about being a part of it.
Well, it was interesting. Ulu Grossbord was the director, and the main editor was Barry Malkin, who was one of my mentors. And I was hired as the first assistant. And the writer was Herb Gardner, who became a close friend. What had happened was that they were pressing schedule on Ulu, and so they needed to get more work done quickly, and so they needed to bring on another editor. And Barry's suggestion was that they upgrade me to associate editor, and that I could work with Herb Gardner exclusively on certain scenes. And that's how I got the associate's degree. The associate's degree is an interim step toward becoming full editor. And I was at that point where I was ready. I had done a few associate things, and in fact, Kellerman actually led to my becoming a full editor. And so I was Herb Gardner and I worked together on several scenes throughout the picture. And I got to know Herb Gardner really well, and that led to several other jobs. And so Kellerman was a very strange picture to work on. Dustin was amazing. He's a maniac, but he was really he was a maniac on that film. But I loved every moment of it, and I've never seen a guy with such dedication to. I mean, I've seen a lot of people do that, but he was his head was totally into it. And so, recollections. I do some strange little stories around it. I can remember I was on set one day, and Harry Horner was the production designer, and he had done a number of films. And I happened to be on set, and we're down and he's talking to him, and his son was with him. And his kid, I don't know, he must have been about 19 or something like that. I started talking to his own kid, and little did I know, you know, who he would end up being. We'll let you guess who that is. James Horner, the composer.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, there's a lot of, there's a year's work called Mishpucha, which means family. And the movie business is a family business, really, still is, you know. And I always reflect on that moment of meeting him. And I've had a lot of moments like that, you know. People who, when he was working at a commercial house, Barry was cutting his first feature, Barry Malkin. It was called The Rain People, which Francis Coppola had directed. And there was this kid following him around with a 16-millimeter Claire camera doing a featurette on the making of The Rain People. And I got to sit down and talk to the kid. And, you know, that kid was George Lucas. I had a life loaded with that kind of experiences, you know, people. There was an old saying in the movie business, be kind to everybody. You never know who's going to show up in some important position. And that's absolutely true. Totally true.
Jeez. So around that time that you were just speaking of, you have an early credit for The Exorcist as well.
That's an assist. I was the assistant editor on The Exorcist.
Assistant film editor.
Film editor, yeah. And really interesting. That film was edited. The Exorcist was edited at 666 Fifth Avenue.
Jeez.
The Tishman Building. Warner's had some offices there, and they wanted us to use the space. But I always think that was kind of wild.
That is.
It was really, there's so many great Exorcist stories. I think my favorite, and I hope Billy forgives me for telling this, but it's the absolute truth. It came time to do the music for the film, and we had moved from New York to Burbank for Warner Brothers. And he was thinking about the music and what kind of music he wanted, and it was very difficult to figure out for that. He wanted something really unique, and so he was thinking of different musicians to call in and see who could really contribute to it. And he came up with Lalo Schifrin, who was a jazz pianist from South America. And for some reason, Billy trusted me. I was in on a lot of meetings, and he always wanted me there, and I never really knew why, except that he trusted me. And so I was in a meeting with Billy, and he called Lalo in, and Lalo is there, and freaking says to Lalo, I want you to bring me something entirely different. You know, Lalo had done the theme to Mission Impossible. you know, Fender bass, flute, bloop, 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 Fender bass, bloop, bloop, bloop. And he said, I want you to bring me something different. And Lalo said, I will do that, Billy. I will do that for you, you know. And in those days, when you did a score, you'd sit down, you'd spot the film with the composer. He'd go away for 6 weeks, and you'd all show up at a studio, and whatever happened there is what you got, you know. And so he was away for 6 weeks, and then we're going to the actual score. It's a big stage at Warner Brothers. There are like 90 musicians. His family's there. His friends are there. His managers, our producers, everybody is there. And he says, he's in front of the orchestra. He turns to us. We're in a separate booth. There was a producer's booth and an engineer's booth. Billy and I were the only ones in the producer's booth. And Lalo turns to Billy and he says, Billy, I will now play the team for when the astronaut comes down and she pees on the floor. And, you know, it was just a standard, you know, sort of standard American songbook kind of thing. And so he plays it, and it's, you know, he's playing, and she, you're going to die up there, and she pees on the floor, and the music's going on, playing totally against it. And he finishes it, right? And he turns around, and he says, how do you like? And Billy nods his head. And then he said, now I will do the main theme. And he starts playing the main theme, and it's beep, 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 boom, boom, boom. Beep, 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 boom, 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 Fender bass. It's Mission Impossible. And Billy's sitting right next to me, and I can feel the energy. And I'm going, holy shit. I got to turn and look at him. I just got to see what his reaction is. And he's like 2 feet away from me. And I turn and look. I've never seen anybody turn that magenta. He really turned unbelievably red, and he's getting furious, right? And it still continues. He's still doing Mission Impossible, right? And so Lalo finishes the cue, right? And he turns around and he says, so, Billy, what do you think? Billy leans over and presses the talk back button. He says, that sucks, you're fired. Got up and walked out. everybody's going, what? You know, 90 musicians, his wife, his family, the managers. Lalo comes running into me. He says, Greg, Greg, what do I do? What do I do? You know, I say, go talk to Billy. Billy wouldn't talk to him. He just did not deliver, you know, totally misunderstood or whatever. But that's a classic Hollywood story for The Exorcist.
That might be the best story anybody's ever told on our podcast.
Say again? I missed that. I missed what
you said. That's the best story anybody's ever told.
I got a couple
podcast.
Of them. My favorite stories. My favorite story is in Reds, which I was working on this scene with Beatty, and I was cutting it together. My assistant was Joel Savitt on that, and I'm cutting the scene, and there's one shot of Beatty, first of all, let me start all of this up by saying, when I first started on Reds, Warren Beatty told me one thing. He said, Craig, I want you to know I'm the biggest narcissist in Hollywood. I just know that. I said, okay. So anyway, now I'm working on this scene with Beatty, and I'm putting the shots together, and there's this one close-up in which his performance is really good. And I, you know, he did a lot of takes, but this one was really incredible. His acting was good. Camera was good. Everything was good. The only thing was he had slight crow's feet on his right eye. And I showed it to my assistant, Joel, and she said, well, I said, he's great, so I'm going to put it in. And she goes, I don't know. And so I said, I'm going to put it in. And so I put it in, and then I called Warren in to come look at the scene. He came in, and I played the scene for him. And he was quiet for a moment. He said, yeah, that's really good. That's excellent. I love the scene. He said, but you know that one shot of me, you know, and he's talking about the close-up, of course. And, you know, that one shot, and I said, yeah. I said, you're really good at that one. You're really good at it. He says, don't you think it shows a little too much character? And I said, well, and that was it. You know, close-up never made it in the movie. So.
I just revisited Reds last week, and It really is something else. I mean, it's there are so few movies that are like it. There are so few movies that feel that epic in scope and yet intimate sort of in like all of the fine character details and everything else. Working with Dee Dee Allen on that film had to have been just like, I would have to imagine for any, editor, young quote unquote editor at the time that you were, that just had to have been absolutely staggering to be a part of. You had mentioned that you worked on that film for 2 years.
Yeah. Well, it was a couple of reasons for that. But the thing about working with Dee, I was not green. I had cut some movies and I've had some experiences and awards, but I was still fairly young. And the thing about working with Dee Dee is that the relationship was very interesting because very little was said. We sort of knew what the scene needed, and we go, "Well, we do that, and and then we go do it," because it was really clear what it needed. So, and I think we borrowed a little. I had started to develop a very smooth style. I mean, I think I was a chief proponent of the invisible cut, and Dee Dee was more direct, and somehow we started to share each other's styles, and it happened quite naturally. So it was a great experience, and I was very privileged to worked with her. And the reason it took 2 years is that Warren shot 3 million feet of film.
that gives a run for his money. And David Fincher, 3 million feet of film.
And a normal movie was about 500,000 feet, and he shot 3 million. And and this is before Avid or anything. All that movie is also cut on Moviola's and Steenbeck. So we needed a way to go through all of it. I remember, and the studio was on it because the interest on the initial loan was $350,000 a month in those days, and they were pressing us to get it done, and we had miles of footage that had to be gone through. And he was shooting 2 cameras, 30,000 feet a day. The cameras were getting so hot that they had to switch them out for Techniscope cameras that wouldn't overheat. We had heard about a system that Kubrick had used on The Shining that his editor, Ray Lovejoy, developed. And it was creating a film chain out of a moviola and then transferring it to beta and then running it on a beta deck. That way we could punch up a footage on each line and go through film very fast. And so we used that system. We bought it from Kubrick. And we used that system on Reds, Dee Dee and I did. And that got us, that picked us, we picked up quite a bit of mileage that way. But still, that was a daunting, it was a daunting effort. We had the largest post-production crew in history in the editorial. We had 64 people working for us. And we broke it down into departments. There's a trim department, an optical department, an old folks department. They were a whole other separate thing that Catherine Wenning oversaw. And he had started shooting Reds. He started shooting the old people before he started shooting the movie. And Vittorio Storaro would travel the country with his little black tent and shoot all of these people. And by the time we finished the film, I think about 80% of them had passed away.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, I got to tell you, the first cut we saw of Reds was spectacular. It was way too long. But it was, in my book, it was every bit as good as Kane. It was a magnificent movie. All of us, we got up after the lights went up and we were just stunned. What an extraordinary picture. Of course, we couldn't release that picture.
How much longer was it?
I think it was almost 4 hours. And we got it down to 3:20. And Dee Dee and I wanted to take 20 minutes out of it. Kind of a Warren wouldn't do it. He refused to do it. And that's how we ended up with an intermission. And I think it's one of the last pictures with an intermission, I think. I'm not sure. But 3 hours and 20 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to. Oh, go ahead, Nick.
No. You go ahead. Jump in.
That's incredible. With Reds is just such a. That's about as epic as a film can get, in my opinion. I think that film is just so giant on such a fantastic scope.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. There had to be, I don't even know what to say to that. Honestly, I'm like flabbergasted at the moment.
We were too.
I wanted to ask you about. I know I spoke with you previously about this, but I view Silence of the Lambs as one of the very few perfect films that have ever been made. You know, I think that's up there with Chinatown, the first two Godfather films, where each time I watch it, I never grow tired of it, and it's just this marvel to watch because I think, you know, absolutely everything in that film is pristine and crisp and clean. And how did you achieve that?
You know, it's well, first of all, first and foremost in our mind in telling the story was to never let the audience get ahead of the story. So that you never knew which way it was going to go. Of course, if people have read the book, they knew it, but if a moviegoer had never read the book, wouldn't know. And that was our priority. In terms of my contribution, I had become really involved with narrative myself. I was developing some, you know, ideas about that, and pushing the narrative forward was my priority. And this is the perfect film to do it with. And so I was very cautious about staying in one place too long, even a fraction of a second. And so it's that film really moves along quite swiftly. And I paid attention to that as much as I could. I mean, every second I paid attention to it. I think I told you when we discussed it briefly that it's the only film I got to do everything I wanted to do as an editor. And then I think there's one shot that's one frame too long.
Which shot?
I can't remember. Some close-up. I just remember seeing it. And you know, the main thing I was concerned with was the moving the narrative forward. And I was very much involved with the rhythm of storytelling. I think it's something that's, overlooked quite a bit, how something rhythmically presents itself to an audience. And so that was an important consideration for me when I was putting it together. And I was being very precise. I was making the cleanest cuts I could make, the most invisible cuts I could make. I didn't want anything to get in the way of that story. I mean, you know, it was interesting. One day I was working on it, and I looked down the hall, and I see Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Demme coming toward my cutting room. And one of the things I really try to discourage is actors visiting the editor. You know, they all want to talk about their close-ups and stuff. You know, so, but here they were. They were coming down the hallway, and so they entered the cutting room, and John said to the when do we want to talk to you about, a couple of things. And so Tony said to me, he said, Craig, he says, you know that scene where I do this and then I sort of do that. And then if I do this other piece of stuff, it's not any good. And then I said, Tony, it's not in the movie. And he goes, thank you. Thank you. So, but you know, it was a great moment. Short but great. he also, so I can remember once I was on set, he was sitting there in a high chair, and I guess it's the scene in the cell where he kills the police officer, beats up. You know, he's sitting there in pure white. He's got blood on his shirt and blood around his mouth, and he's sitting there in a high director's chair reading Eudora Welty. He turned to me and says, he said, "Greg, I'm mad, you know, I'm totally mad." And then went back to his book.
I'm with Frank in that it's a movie that feels perfect to my eye. I've seen it multiple times. I never grow tired of it. It immediately sucks you into the story, the way that you guys put, you know, everything together in that film. It moves with such a great sense of pacing, and everything, all of the decision making in that movie just feels smart, from how the performances were performed, to the way that Demme directed all of it, the way that it's edited, the way that Tak Fujimoto shot it. It's one of those things where I've always felt that when, you know, a great director pairs up with a great cinematographer and a great editor repeatedly, they get on a sort of wavelength, and they sort of, you know, there's a shorthand, and they understand the ins and outs of each other's creative process. So
totally,
I would only have
that's
to.
That's totally true. Lamb's totally true. Absolutely.
And,
true.
And it just, it's so abundantly clear in the work. I mean, you know, we could have a 4-hour podcast with you, to be honest with you. I mean, the amount of stuff that you've done is just, it's insane. And when you look at when you look at Demme's work that you've worked on with him, you know, it's like the key stuff from him is, and for me, it's some of the really the key stuff from him as a filmmaker and as a storyteller. And it's just very clear that you guys were really in tune with each other as artists. I wanted to ask, because because we've been focusing on, you know, some of the stuff that's been, you know, earlier, you know, early in the career, and, you know, at the midpoint, you've had some really interesting stuff over the last few years. One of them being a movie called Sin Nombre, which I'm a massive fan of. I think that it's one of the most underrated movies out there. You know, Cary Fukunaga has now gotten popular because of True Detective, and now he's got Beasts of No Nation coming out, which everyone's going to be all over. But I would love to know how you hooked up with him on Sin Nombre and how that project came about for you.
Well, it's interesting. Just a side note about Cary Fukunaga, who I think is one of the major talents we have in the film business. I mean, he's just, I expect extraordinary things from him. I worked with a lot of young directors, but nobody has impressed me to the extent that Cary has. He is an extraordinary talent. We're going to see a lot of great things from him, I'm sure. I'm sure. How I got on it. He was working in Toronto with his editor, and I got a call from my agent saying that they needed some help editorially. And would I be interested in going up to Toronto to work with them? And they were having problems with getting the story to play, basically. And it was, he's working with Luis Carvalho, and they had a full cut together, but it wasn't. I think the producer and Cary were thinking it's not playing as well as it could play, so they called me. And I went up to Toronto. I met with him before I took the job. I said, "I want to meet you guys." I said, "You're calling me in, and I'm going to, you know, make suggestions, and I'm going to be emphatic. That's what they're paying me to do. If you guys have a problem with that, I won't take the job." They both agreed that that was okay. So I came on, and we totally recut the movie. Everything was there. It just needed some pacing. And it needed some other performance decisions. But Cary had managed to capture everything. It just needed some, it needed a very fine polish, which I was able to give it. And, you know, I worked with Lewis and we worked that out. That worked pretty well, but I practically made a change to every cut in that movie.
The editing is one of the main, everything about that movie to me is just like so perfectly put together, and it takes you on such a hellish journey And it's one of those movies that will be a tough sit for some people because of the fact that it really paints, from what I would have to assume, an unfortunately an all too realistic portrait of that lifestyle of people suffering in that, you know, in those situations. And one of the things about the movie that really strikes me is the propulsive nature of the storytelling, especially in the second half. So to hear you say that you came in and essentially, you know, recut the entire film and made changes to every scene, it's just amazing to hear, because, you know, you just, these are the things you don't ever get a chance to hear. You know, you sit down, you see a movie, you take it for face value and that everything was perfect. But yeah, it's just, it's a really awesome film.
Well, when I saw the first cut, I knew everything was there. I knew it. He had delivered. But, you know, sometimes you get in the trenches and you can't see stuff. I mean, there's a, you know, I'm very proud of that film. I think that's one of the best films I've worked on. And I've been fortunate enough to work on a number of good films, and that's one of them. That's one I'm very proud of the contribution, and proud to have worked with Carrie and Lewis. And Amy Kaufman, who's the producer. You know, I'm really disappointed that it didn't get more recognition. It got some, but it didn't get what it deserved, I felt, you know. But Sam, you don't know sometimes you're in the trenches. Even when we were on Silence of the Lambs and we were cutting it, there was one point where in the story, Clarice gets taken off the case because they discover that she's given Lecter a fake offer, so they take her off the case. And I was working with that and with Jonathan in the movie, we were trying to make it work. And every time we got to that scene, because the narrative was moving forward at such an incredible pace, she got laid off, everything stopped. So, and then we had to start the movie up again, and it always felt like it wasn't working, and we couldn't figure out what to do. And so, we got Bill Goldman to come in and take a look at it, and he looked at it and was talking with Jonathan about it, and he said, well, why don't you just lose that scene? Don't ever let her get fired. That'll keep the narrative force going, you know, even faster. And it was that simple. We dropped the scene and the movie worked great, you know, but we couldn't see it because we were in the trenches. So I think some of that was a play on Sinombre, you know, and that does happen. It does happen.
What are, this might be a difficult question, but what are some of your other films that you would hold in that same caliber that you've worked on for your personal preference of your favorite things you've worked on or things you consider your best?
Well, Melvin and Howard is one, definitely.
Yeah.
And definitely, you know, Sinombre and Silence of the Lambs and Philadelphia. I'm very fond of that. That had its own issues. Actually that was radical. I don't know. I'm lucky to have had a large number of films that I really enjoyed working on. A little film that I came in, it was the same kind of situation with Sinombre. They called me in to work on this film called Everything's Illuminated, which Leo Schreiber.
It's a really nice movie.
Yes.
I love that movie. It's very sweet. And we took a lot out of it, you know. It's like, sometimes stuff just gets in the way. I mean, when I did Miami Blues with George Armitage, the first cut was three hours long. Yeah.
Miami
3 hours long.
The first cut of Miami Blues was 3 hours long.
Yeah. And I took an hour and a half out of that. I cut an hour and a half out. I always say I took a movie out of the movie.
It's a tight hour and 40 minutes. It doesn't even feel like, oh God. To hear that movie was 3 hours, that's one of those films that feels so tight and feels so one shot logically leads into the next. There's no fat. There's no filler. It's just like just 1, 2, 3, boom. So to hear you take out an entire film is mind-boggling.
it is. And it was very hard to do, to make it look like I wasn't doing that. But, you know, that was the case. The script was long. I think, you know, it should have been maybe a little longer in development before they started to shoot it. But I'm very pleased with that one. I'm very pleased with that one. That one's become sort of a underground hit on many levels.
I did another film.
A film with Terry George called Some Other Son, which I think is a wonderful film. It's one I'm fond of also. You know, and then there are always a couple you got, you know, you have trouble with, like on Swing Shift, where Jonathan and I did, it was a disaster. Both of us had to leave the film. It was studio interference was big, and the star interference was big, and they were taking the movie in an entirely different direction than what we all agreed to, you know, in terms of starting out. That's really the only one I had a big issue with. And when Jonathan left, the studio wanted me to stay on, and I said, no, I'm not interested. I couldn't work against, you know, my friend's, you know, concept at all. I couldn't even get near that idea. So left that, you know. The ones I'm fond of, but not as much as the ones I've mentioned, you know, I'm fond of Married to the Mob, of course. And,
that's so good.
Yeah, and,
There's a film on your resume that's always hit me really hard, and I've seen it a bunch of times. It's called Return to Paradise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I came in as somebody to help out on that one. It was mostly Andy Munchine's picture, but they needed two people working on it. And so I came in to work on that. I didn't stay on the whole length of it, but I stayed on to help them get their cut together. And then I left. But I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed working with that. Andy Munchie's a really fine editor, so we had good rapport and a good experience. And, we made it a better movie together.
How did the Manchurian Candidate remake come about?
I'm not entirely sure of that. I guess just it was a simple decision. The studio wanted to do it, Carol Littleton. I was working on something else. And Carol Littleton was hired as the main editor on that, and then I became available. And Jonathan and I, he wanted me to come on to work with Carol. So by the time I came on, all of that, you know, had been in place, and I think they were somewhere early in the shooting. So I really wasn't involved in the formative stage of that. But I was very excited at the changes they had made in the story. Of course, I'm a big fan of the original, very fond of that movie. And
the original is one of those, it's one of those classic movies, but, you know, I know Frank and I both feel pretty much the same way on the remake. It's, you know, if you were going to remake such a great film, you guys did such a smart job with updating that material for the time. And it's a very paranoid, very, intense film. It gets under your skin on purpose. And what I've always loved so much about it is that you got this really nervous, jittery performance from an always otherwise smooth and in control Denzel Washington. And it really, really sort of plays against, you know, your expectation of Denzel always being the man of action. And here he's completely vulnerable and messed up and mentally fractured. And, you know, I've always been obsessed with how Demme's framed his actors in the middle of the frame, and then how the editing sort of, you know, complements that shooting style.
That's a really interesting style because, you know, I'm just going to jump back to Lance for a bit. When Jonathan told all the actors he wanted them to look directly in the camera, Jodie Foster was against it. She said, that's never going to work. I don't want to do it. John said, trust me, it's, you know. But she was really against it, of course, you know. She's pissing her Oscar now, so.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But Manchurian Candidate, I was a little apprehensive to work on it because one of my close friends is a woman named Cornelia MacGyver. And her dad was John MacGyver, the senator in the original Manchurian.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. I can remember when I told her I was working on it, I was embarrassed to tell her that I was working on a remake. Yeah, because I mean it's such a classic, and you never know if you're going to live up. At that time, we didn't know how well we were going to do, you know. But you know, and now his son also, Boris MacIver, is becoming a pretty well-known actor, doing a lot of important stuff. So, and there we go with the family and the business again.
Yeah, it always helps to have those connections, but you know it's amazing when you hear the stories about you know the different eras of Hollywood and how people got their start and how you were able to just you know find someone who was willing to show you the ropes and there was no internships and you know you waltzed on you know people waltzed off and on the lot and they found themselves down at a shoot and somebody pulled you under their wing and then they showed you and before you knew it you're off and running and. You know, it speaks to a different time and, in a different sensibility, I think, of people. And it's amazing that, you know, Frank and I have had some conversations with people, you know, like you and some others where, you know, you got your foot in the door truly, you know, at a place of passion for the work and for the creative process. So, like I said, we can.
Go ahead, finish. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say, it's just, you know, we want to be mindful of the time. There's so much stuff on your resume that's just wonderful to talk about. And you've had such a fortunate, you know, career working with these great filmmakers and, you know, and really just always putting out it's very smart editing. Like from you projects and, you know, you've done documentaries and you've done small films and you've done. And, you know, they all have the same sort of sense of intelligence about them. And that's one of the things that I've always loved about, you know, people who have these great bodies of work and they've gone throughout the years working with these great people. You really get a sense of, you know, how accomplished, you know, someone can get.
I think as for myself, knowing what I'll bring to something, I can definitely feel, you know, my sensibilities and everything I've worked on. And I've been fortunate enough to be a significant contributor. There's sometimes, you know, like Demi and I just had a shorthand in a language, like it was what you were talking about before. I cut this one scene in Silence of the Lambs where he's in a cage, she brings the drawings back and they start talking to each other and she eventually tells the story of the Silence of the Lambs. And that's a 10-minute scene. It was the full reel. And I knew what he was after. And it was shot so beautifully. And then I put it together, and it was a very powerful scene. And I invited Tammy to take a look. And he came in, and he looked at it and turned to me after it was over and said, "That's it, fine," and walked out of the room. So that's how close we were. I mean, that's how close we were understanding, you know, each other and what he wanted. And I was able to give it to him, you know. It was a very special relationship, you know. It was very special. And I think we were like brothers, you know. And, at some point, after Manchurian, he wanted to do smaller films. And he always said to me, you know, "I can't afford you anymore." But I'm very proud of the work, the 6 or 7 films we did together, I think. The feedback I'm getting from film students, graduate students, and about that particular body of work, it seems, you know, it's amazing. It kind of hits you like a tsunami. I mean, everybody's really knowledgeable, you know. That was a good one we had.
Yeah, man. That your body of work certainly speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic filmography, and I just can't get over it. I just can't get over. I got to speak with the guy that cut Silence of the Lambs, Reds, Copland, Philadelphia. This has been an incredible chat, Craig. Thank you so very much for taking time out and speaking with us.
Oh, sure. It's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to listening to your podcast.
Yeah, thank you. We'll when we post it, we'll send it over to you.
All right. Thanks, guys. Pleasure talking to you.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very, very much for coming on.
Okay. Bye.